accession number 28361, Reel 64.
They were recruit instructors and things. Yes, there was less. There was less abuse in the sense of, you know, you, blah, 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 you know. There was less verbal abuse of the kind that I used to hear on the playground when I was a young officer coming from the instructors. Which was, you know, there wasn't a lot of swearing, but there was a lot of, you know, sort of, don't hesitate like a fly in a strange shit house and things like that to recruits, which was sort of, you didn't get anymore because you didn't need to. It was not needed. And I think we turned out a better, I think the standard was higher, actually. The training had been refined and unnecessary things had been cut out. And because time was shorter as a result, it was harder because you had to achieve the same end in a shorter time. Whereas a recruit, when I joined in 1952, would start off with 17 weeks at the depot deal, doing drill and PT and nothing else, cleaning his kit, and then do another 17 or 18 weeks of infantry training, and then go and do the commando course, 6 weeks of commando course. And, you know, at the end of that, he was bloody fit. He played loads of sport, played sport every Wednesday afternoon, every Saturday afternoon he'd be playing sport, a whole bloody lot of you out there playing sport. So they were very fit, but they built up to it slowly. Now you're saying to these guys, right, you've got 30 weeks from a standing start, we're a couch potato, where you've got to be, you know, like that,
yeah,
in 30 weeks.
So you have to dedicate more time then to phased physical
training. Phased physical training and supervised. And we had far less injuries in the old days. Mm. Not because the guys were tougher, but because the pace was slower.
Yeah.
That was
well,
why.
This is the difficulty that now, I think, in the Army as well, many more recruits have to repeat.
Yes.
The training. Because
sure.
The impact of the physical training.
Sure.
Is,
I mean, it's quite, I went and visited Limpston the other day because I was opening a new block, and I went round. Mm. And it's amazing how few people that start the training end in the same
intake,
because, you know, 30 guys start, but only about 3 or 10 will finish. The others all finish, but they'll all be in different slices because they're going back and coming, you know, going back and coming and being rehabilitated and then joining, you know. So there's this continual...
It's the relegation cycle.
Yeah, relegation cycle.
Yeah. General Julian Thompson, Reel 64. You were saying that there were certain difficulties with standards of fitness and so forth in the Marines because of the condition of recruits coming in. Was this causing any sort of concern, or was it something that was being
managed? No, the concern was that we were still producing the chap at the end who was required, and that was the main thing. The concern was the huge rate of injuries and of opt-outs and of chuck-outs, which was up to 40%.
That's a very high wastage rate.
It's a very high wastage rate. And of course, it put us into the spotlight all the time of people who said two things. One, you're too expensive. And secondly, why can't you lower the standards, and what does it matter anyway? The latter thing and being pushed quite often by senior naval officers who didn't understand what it was about. And that attitude, I mean, even persists to this day, I'm told. Why do you need to have these high standards? Because they don't understand what you're trying to aim at. So those were the problems. It was really the peripheral things on the fitness, like that, not so much the other, because we could get over it and produce the people we wanted.
Yeah. Well, there's always a conflict between the desire for quality and the desire for quantity.
Yes, there always is. And we were saying we want quality because it's proved itself time and time again, and that quantity really is not actually the answer. And curiously enough, the same thing hit the SAS, when Mike Rose told me that he was under some pressure to increase the size of the SAS and add an extra squadron. He resisted it, saying that the only way you could increase the number of people in the SAS was lowering the standard, because they were already failing huge numbers of people and they were getting as many people as actually wanted to do it. And the only way you could increase the numbers was lowering the standard. And the same would have applied in the Royal Marines.
When you came to the end of this job then at Portsmouth, what were the prospects?
Well, there was a prospect that I might be the Commandant General, but I decided I would leave the Royal Marines because I had personal reasons for doing so. I separated from my wife. And I did that. The Royal Marines were too small a sort of organisation to have the various sort of marital mundungery that was going to follow in its train, and that in any case I didn't think the Commandant General's job was a particularly desirable one, in that you don't actually command anything, you're just a sort of figurehead, and that I said I didn't wish to be considered for it, even if I was being, and that I wished to retire, which I did.
Did you have plans for retirement worked out?
No, not really. I decided I always wanted to write, because I'd written a book in my last job called No Picnic, which was about my brigade in the Falklands. I decided that writing military history was what I was really interested in doing. And at the same time, I recognised I'd probably have to do something else as well. So in fact, what happened was I was offered a research fellowship at King's College London for 3 years. At the same time, I was offered a consultancy job with a firm called, in those days, Alexander Stenhouse, who were city insurance brokers who wanted someone to advise them on security and terrorism. So I actually had two jobs.
Yes.
And this led, in the fullness of time, to me having three. Still, in that I'm an author with 8 published books under my belt, another 2 about to come out this year, and I've signed up for 2 more. I'm a chairman of a security company, and I'm a consultant with another, so I have 3 jobs, effectively. And it's what I do now.
Do you find that being a... Well, did you find that it was a shock to become a civilian? Was it difficult or easy to adjust to?
It was
civil life as opposed to service life.
It wasn't a shock in the sense that any changes I had were buffeted by my change of circumstance and the fact that I moved from the West Country to London. So I was actually starting with a clean sheet, and as it were. Secondly, I'd had a very satisfying service career and I didn't want to repeat any of it. I didn't feel that I wanted to go back, and I still don't feel like that. I think that I was also lucky in that I wasn't going to work, as so many servicemen do, in another hierarchical setup and having to learn a new set of rules. I mean, I was self-employed from the minute I left, so I ran my own. I mean, I ran my own life, so I didn't have to adjust to some managing director who, you know, I found difficult to work with, or some chairman that I couldn't stand. I didn't belong to anybody, and that was one of the reasons I did it. I decided I'd worked in 34 years in a hierarchical structured organisation, and I wanted to do something different with the rest of my life, and that's what I do. And of course it's precarious in the sense that you don't have a salary and you have to earn your money with your pen and your wits, such as they are. So there are moments when you wonder when the next crust is coming from. And sometimes, you know, it's feast or famine sometimes. But I find it enormously fulfilling and rewarding. And I think the difference is something that one notices, that in the services, the Royal Marines, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, if you say to someone, I'd like that done, it's normally done. Usually before the time that you've asked for it to be finished. In civil life, that is very rarely the case, even in companies that would regard themselves as being highly efficient. I mean, Alexander and Alexander were very efficient brokers, and I worked with them for 11 years, and I liked all the people immensely, but I wouldn't like to say they were highly honed to the standards that I had become used to. The other thing I think that is that a lot of people outside who never rubbed up against the services don't understand is the relationship between the commanded and the commanders, which was summed up to me by a chap, quite a senior director, said to me, you must find it, you know, very, I can't remember what the word was, rewarding or refreshing or freedom, you know, to be able to work in an organization like this where, you know, there's no sort of hierarchy, nobody calling people sir and things like that. And I said, my dear chap, you don't realize actually how hierarchical you are. I said, I knew what every Marine or soldier I commanded thought, because he told me usually, or I learnt what he thought. And he never hesitated to, in the politest possible way. I said, if one of your secretaries turned round and said to you some of the things that my men had said to me, they'd be sacked for impertinence. It's true, isn't it?
I've no experience of commercial life, so I don't know.
Oh, it is. It is true. But they don't like to hear. There's nothing like the free interchange of, you know, that you get in the service.
It's certainly true that Sandhurst cadets would say what they thought normally.
Yeah, sure.
They were very courteous, but extraordinarily critical.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, all the Marines I've ever met in all my 34 years service, all the soldiers I've ever met, sailors, were always very polite. But you always knew exactly what they thought about the situation because they told you. But you wouldn't get that in commercial life because people would be frightened that they'd get sacked. And also the other thing was people used to sit working at their desks long after they had to because they were frightened to say, well, I've done my work, I'm going now. So people would be driving in from Reading at sort of 4 o'clock in the morning in order to get the beat the rush hour. Because they couldn't bear to cause not to drive in their company Jaguar. And then staying working till 9 to avoid the rush hour back. But often they weren't actually achieving anything.
It's a question of form rather than substance.
Form rather than substance. Some of them, I mean, don't get me wrong, a lot bloody hard. I mean, the stock exchange and bankers, they work every hour God sends them. They do work bloody hard. But there is this sort of, if you're not at your desk beavering away, you're loafing.
It's the maintenance of appearances, too.
It's the maintenance of appearances. And there's a lot of that that goes on. And sort of what I would call sort of keeping up with the Joneses stuff. Which you don't get in what is a hierarchy. That's the irony of it. In a hierarchical setup.
Well, there is a difference between a functional hierarchy that has a purpose and a hierarchy of status.
Yeah, sure.
Which doesn't necessarily have a functional purpose.
No. So I mean, those are the things that I notice out.
Looking back overall, was it 30 years, 34 years?
34 years.
What do you think are the principal advantages or disadvantages of having been in the service?
I can think of practically no disadvantages except of one of perception of other people saying you've had no commercial experience and therefore, you know, I can't give you this job. And I'm talking in general terms, no, not me, because I wasn't looking for that sort of job. But that's the thing they'll say.
Yeah.
The advantage is having served in an organization which had the highest standards and which included some of the best people that one could ever hope to meet of every rank. And which is a family which you still belong to, which I still belong to today. So that immediately you're back with those people, even if they're people you actually haven't served with, but they've been in it, you have a sort of empathy with them because they know that you and you know that they have been through the same system. They're part of this family.